Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
We've all heard the phrase. It refers to the inherent uncertainty that surrounds conflict, and it's often and incorrectly attributed to the famous Prussian strategist Karl von Clausewitz. In fact, though, Clausewitz never talked about the fog of war. In his writings, he used a different word, friction, to describe the challenge of operating on the battlefield with incomplete information. Even so, the concept stands. Over the years, the fog of war has become shorthand for the gaps in understanding that tend to plague parties to a conflict. These could be uncertainties about a country's own capability, or those of its adversaries, or the intentions that drive foreign leaders to make what seem like irrational decisions during wartime. And today, that fog is getting thicker, because all of those wartime challenges are being compounded, dramatically so, by disinformation, propaganda, and false narratives, whether it's generated by governments, by political partisans, or by other players entirely. There is now a massive amount of noise, both in the media and online. For journalists, correspondents, and analysts, this poses a huge problem. And someone who knows this very well is Shashank Joshi. Shashank is the defense editor of The Economist, a position he's held since 2018. Before that, he was a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, one of Britain's premier think tanks, as well as a research associate at Oxford University's Changing Character of War program. If you've ever read any of The Economist's coverage of conflicts around the world, chances are you've seen Shashank's work. So I was thrilled to have a chance to speak with him about the practical difficulties of getting war reporting right, especially in an age of growing information disorder. Shashank, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really, really glad to join you.
You've heard my intro, so you've been warned. I didn't want to talk about Karl von Clausewitz per se, mostly because given your background, you know much more about him than I do. But I do want to begin with the concept that I flagged in the intro. That is the idea of the fog of war, the challenges it poses, not just to military officers, which is a separate conversation, but for those of us who are trying to accurately track what's happening in conflicts where the pace of the fight is moving very quickly, this is a real issue. So I was wondering, to start us off, talk about how you and your colleagues at The Economist deal with it. How do you sort of cut through the fog?
There's a great Clausewitz quote that I like, apart from the very famous ones, which says, everything in war is very simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. And I think that's a useful guide to kind of the information environment we're in as well, because you have this remarkable flood of open source intelligence enabled by a profusion of smartphones, dash cams, other kind of sensors that are producing unprecedented quantities of video footage, images from war zones, in ways that would not have been possible in conflicts 15 or 20 years ago. But of course, that presents huge challenges of understanding authenticity, reliability, context. And so how do we deal with it? Well, I think first of all, we start from a position of innate skepticism. That is, if someone is showing you a video of a Russian ship blowing up, you do not get on Twitter and tweet, "My goodness, a Russian ship just blew up." You stop, right? And this is actually surprisingly difficult for us, given how tempting it is, the allure of being first with news, the allure of having stuff out there, recirculating it, participating in a kind of collective information endeavor. Actually, sometimes you have to stop. And I think being a weekly magazine at The Economist, albeit one with a much more aggressive digital output these days, that helps. We don't feel we have to be first with everything. And that buys us a little bit of time and space for thinking. I think the second aspect of this, Ilan, is that traditional journalism is still essential. That is, if someone is telling you a Russian ship blew up and they have a video that appears to show that, you do some sort of traditional digging. You pick up the phone, you call contacts in different countries, you speak to Ukrainians, you speak to Russians, you ask, you know, what do you think? Is this correct? Are we sure this isn't an old video? So absolutely good old-fashioned picking up the phone, calling people, or in some cases, depending on the sensitivity of the information, saying, hey, can you meet me for a drink in a couple of hours to discuss something sensitive? If there's incredibly sensitive news, and on some of the things we may discuss later on, we may come across some of these examples. And I think the final piece of the puzzle here is We have all had to get better at digital forensics. We have all, traditional, you know, journalists who may not be accustomed to this, have had to get better at the arts of geolocation. That is, can we discern where a video was taken by identifying features in the background? We've all had to become, to a degree, weapons experts, or at least understand how to find weapons expertise. That is, if I see a crater, do I know which weapon made this? And understanding things like ballistics. So this has become a much more interdisciplinary process in which different scientific technical disciplines have become more important as the complexity of these issues has grown over time.
Okay, so let's talk about Ukraine for a bit. Over the years, Russia has rightly become notorious for its use of disinformation as a weapon, both of politics and of war. So it's not really surprising that we've seen an awful lot of it since February of 2022. But what are the main narratives that the Kremlin is pushing in Ukraine and beyond? And what are they intended to do, to your mind?
We could be here all day discussing this. And let me just try and pick out the most important. I think the first is the narrative that Ukraine is a failed state, a fictional country, an appendage of Russia, and a country that is corrupt and ruled by Nazis. That was the kind of the intellectual basis for the invasion in 2022. But I also want to take it beyond that, because what we're seeing recently, and I've been covering from the standpoint of covering Russian intelligence agencies, is this effort to try to find existing wedge issues and drive them open inside Europe in the way that was done in the United States in 2016. And here, I think the narrative is that Ukraine is losing the war, that Russian victory is inevitable because Russian mass firepower and resilience prevails, as it did in the Russian fake imagination in World War II, where Russia defeated Nazism single-handedly without the assistance of any other countries, which, of course, as we know, is a completely spurious historical claim, and that Western support for this regime is futile and is eroding. That's the narrative I see being pushed in Europe, particularly in the last few months. But in addition to that, I also see provocations intended to increase the perception of disarray in Europe. Let me give you an example of that. In the last few months, the Estonians have arrested, I think, more than 10 people who are thought to be basically operatives working on behalf of the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. And, you know, it's not that they were doing sophisticated information operations. It's that they were doing things like fomenting protests to make it look as though there was grassroots, organic opposition to support for Ukraine. In France, we saw France attribute, I think, the daubing of a Star of David's against Jewish businesses and sites in Paris, attributed to the FSB. Now, why would they do that? It was, of course, in order to make it appear as though these social divisions are wider than they actually are. It's not to say these things don't exist. Of course, anti-Semitism exists in France and in Europe, but it's to widen these divisions, to accentuate them, and to make it look as though these governments have no ability to contain these problems. And I think the final point I'll comment on is we have continued to see cyber operations apace. Two examples, the Germans discovered bot networks of millions of bots, I think on Facebook in January, and the French in a report, I think it was called Portal Combat, they also identified various Russian-backed groups, basically saying things like the war is lost, Ukraine can't win, driving those divisions through to try and sap European morale for the war effort.
Right. And this is happening not only by Russia and not only in the context of Ukraine. The obvious second front that we're looking at in disinformation terms is the war in Gaza. And I've been really struck by how this phenomenon is playing out in the context between Israel and Hamas in that conflict. For instance, Hamas has been extremely efficient in rapidly relaying and disseminating casualty counts from Israeli military operations. And let's be clear, there's definitely reason for humanitarian concern here, but those figures are almost certainly cooked because the group controls the Gaza Health Ministry, and inflating the figures has the political effect of diminishing support for Israel. So that seems to me to be a huge dilemma, because there's quite literally no alternative sources of figures and facts about what's going on in the Gaza Strip. How are you guys navigating this?
With humility and caution. First of all, openness and transparency is important. It's about acknowledging where your figures come from, the provenance of those figures. It's about acknowledging that the Hamas Health Ministry is an entity that is controlled by Hamas, one of the belligerents in this conflict. and that the group is a sanctioned terrorist organization in Europe, and the same context we would provide in comparable circumstances. It's also about accepting uncertainty. And here's where I my position has evolved, and I accept a very high degree of uncertainty around this question. It's about acknowledging that in past conflicts, Palestinian health ministry figures have often actually tallied with Israeli figures, but the key differences have been on the proportion of combatants to non-combatants. And that has been a source of real division and uncertainty in the past. Hamas, the health ministry, does not distinguish between these in its public figures. And there is a great deal of debate about what that means, which I think would take us a much longer conversation to get into. But it's about, I think, trying to give readers a sense of that, not just kind of infantilizing them by giving them the headline figure and leaving it at that, making sure we take the space occasionally to explain how some of this occurs, but also the differences in the present conflict, the fact that the NGOs and humanitarian organizations that were able to verify or corroborate some of these figures in the past do not enjoy the same access in Gaza that they do today, that they have done in the past, and that complicates the effort. Now, the final thing is also to sort of, again, be careful of rushing to judgment. And certainly the thing that shaped a lot of people's perceptions in this conflict early on was the strike on Al-Ali Hospital. And we can go into that, but clearly that was a case where, you know, there is still some uncertainty, but a rigorous assessment of the forensic evidence available, the images, the crater, really undercut some of the initial assumptions that this was an Israeli strike. And I think a lot of news organizations messed that up. And this is categorically not a statement that the IDF is infallible or that as journalists, we take the IDF's word for everything, which is we would never do. I wouldn't do it for any armed force on the planet, and I wouldn't do it for the IDF. But I think that episode does also show us how sometimes you just have to wait for evidence to come in before you can reach a judgment. But initial conclusions, if made hastily, can really stick and shape popular perceptions.
Okay, so let's zoom out. How are governments adapting to all this? What are you seeing countries do to cut through the fog of war today in the current media environment? Because traditionally, the way to minimize uncertainty is through things like better intelligence. But that doesn't necessarily apply here, or does it?
Well, I think I'd sort of point to a few things. One of them is the trend of pre-bunking. I mentioned earlier how initial perceptions and claims can shape the environment, can anchor expectations. People who of course, have read the studies of Kahneman and Tversky will understand how anchoring effects can work, how initial numbers that are thrown out there, initial facts, can shape subsequent expectations. Well, pre-bunking is an effort to try and get ahead of the story and to preempt an adversary's claim. The canonical example recently being American and European efforts to try to warn of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and specifically warning that Russia would try to resort to the use of false flags and fake chemical weapons attacks to justify its invasion. We saw this in January, February 2022. And I think that although that didn't deter the invasion, it was effective in removing the sting of Russian claims, which were subsequently shown to be hollow, which may not have been received with the same skepticism in the absence of that publicly declassified intelligence. So intelligence does make a difference. The second aspect, Ilan, is rapid rebuttal. Rapid rebuttal is also an important part of this, right? The example I'll give actually goes back 6 years, which is the attempted assassination of Sergei Skripal, the former Russian intelligence officer poisoned by Novichok in the English city of Salisbury back in 2018. The British government's response at the time was, I think, a model for how to do some of this. They cataloged all the like 15, 16 different, you know, nonsense narratives being put out by the Russians. Everything from they weren't poisoned to they disappeared to they poisoned themselves to the British secret services did it to the Americans did it. These, you know, the Russian approach being, of course, to throw and see what sticks. And they cataloged them and put them all out there, exposing the absurdity of this, but also rebutting each one with facts very quickly, within minutes or within hours, not allowing these claims to enter the ecosystem and be circulated on Russia Today in 15 different countries. So that rapid rebuttal is absolutely a critically important part of this. I think the final point is being able to brief on the nuance and subtleties of different problems, right? And so, for example, what we have seen in the context of Ukraine is British Defense Intelligence offering a daily Twitter update on what's happening on the ground. Now, I have my issues with this. You know, I think that some of these updates can actually undermine governmental credibility, because if you only present a one-sided picture of a situation, if you only sort of continually find reasons why the Russians are doing terribly, you will begin to lose credibility in the balanced and complete nature of your judgments. But I think that degree of public engagement, that constant engagement to provide context on Russian losses, on what's happening on the ground, that's a new feature of this conflict. You know, we didn't get that in Syria, in the Syrian civil war, in Libya 2011. It's new, it's interesting, and I think the jury is out on how effective it is.
And all of this, I think, gets us to what I would call digital guardrails. Right now, the online space in particular is a little bit of a free-for-all, and I would argue that's not a good thing. In war, passions run high, and every side believes it has the moral high ground. And it also wants bystanders to see things its way and not its adversary's way. Whether it's Ukraine or Gaza, which we've talked about, we see this playing out on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and any number of other platforms. Is big tech doing anything of substance in response here?
My understanding is that technology companies have invested quite a lot in automated means of detecting certain types of content. They did that in part in the ISIS years because there was such a profusion of terrorist propaganda coming out of Syria and Iraq from groups like ISIS that was often very violent, very propagandistic, very lurid. Now, that's easy enough. I think the challenge that they face is sort of that as we enter an era of more generated synthetic content, you know, AI generated deep fakes, whether that is fake audio, fake video, fake images, there's two issues. One of them is the process of detecting that, as you know, is still in its infancy, right? We have no reliable means of watermarking these things or in detecting fakes that is foolproof. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is even more basic. If somebody is putting out an image of the Syrian civil war and saying that it comes from Gaza, or they're putting out a picture of Ukraine from Donetsk, but they're saying, but it's actually a picture that was taken from Mariupol in the first week of the conflict. There is no magical computer solution that is going to detect that and is going to immediately detect it and throw up a red flag. So I think there's a technical challenge there. I have seen some interesting efforts at trying to throw grit in the wheels of this stuff. So for example, on Twitter, if you try to share an article without having read it, if you repost it, as you know, for the last 18 months or so, Twitter will ask you or X will ask you, hey, you haven't read this. Do you want to read it before you share it? And sometimes, you know, like maybe it's a piece that I wrote. So I'm like, no, I don't want to read it before I share it. I'm going to share it. But I find that an interesting way of throwing sort of sand in the wheels. Similarly, on WhatsApp, you know, a country like India, where WhatsApp was used to spread huge amounts of disinformation, politically charged disinformation, WhatsApp or its parent company, Meta, responded by limiting the number of mass forwards that you could conduct from a single account. Again, this isn't a surefire solution, but the theoretical model is, let's just put some friction in the process. Let's slow down the mass sharing of all of this. The final point to make is that this isn't just a kind of voluntary regime that we have to deal with. There's a legal question here as well. In the UK, we recently had a case, I think it was a deep fake of Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London. And what transpired was, this was, I think, a pretty inflammatory edit to what he had said. And the police said, we can't do anything about this because this is not illegal. Now, okay, a responsible tech company may take that down. In a one-off case, that's fine. But the legal framework is yet to catch up with some of these problems in a number of countries. And this being an election year in so many places, in your country, in mine, in many other places, I think that is going to throw up some really challenging examples, both for the private sector, but also for the law.
I think that's absolutely right. And to me, this is, in the public diplomacy and strategic communication sphere, this is the next great debate, right? That whoever inherits the White House after November is going to have to deal with in terms of regulation and also in terms of guardrails. So let me end this with one last question. And I want to do something a little bit different. I want to borrow your crystal ball a bit, because your job is quite literally to keep an eye on global conflicts and from there on to explain them to foreign audiences. So tell us what conflicts or emerging crises you're seeing that we're not paying attention to. What should we be looking at to get ahead of the news?
Can I give you three examples, Ilan? So let me start with, Europe. Moldova, small country, doubt all that many Americans have been there or maybe could place it on a map. I don't think many Europeans could place it on a map, by the way. We have seen a ramping up of Russian threats against Moldova, disinformation, as we talked about at the beginning, about its quest for EU membership, Russian efforts to try to personally denigrate the leadership of Moldova, the pro-Western leadership. And of course, the small enclave of Transnistria, which is a site present with Russian peacekeepers, where there has been a surge in tension recently. So, you know, if you go to Ukraine, go to the far southwestern edge, look at that tiny little place wedged between Ukraine and NATO member states. Keep an eye on it. Read the news, raising a red flag right now. Let's remember that, along with the Western Balkans to the west, where Russia and Russian intelligence has been very active in trying to kind of make inroads in a place where the West doesn't really pay as much attention as it should. Number two, in Asia, we all think a lot about Taiwan, and rightly so. The last 6 months, a lot of the action has been in the Philippines, around Second Thomas Shoal, a pretty small rocky outcrop in the South China Sea, where China has been using extraordinary bullying tactics against a treaty ally of the United States, the Philippines. Just in the last weeks before we're speaking, Ilan, we've seen a Chinese vessel use its water cannon to smash the window screen of a Filipino vessel. And I think what we're seeing is these little hotspots, apart from the big ones, flare up, and China testing boundaries and testing American resolve at a time when America's distracted with big problems at home, big problems in Europe. And the third and final example I want to give is India-China. India and China in 2020 had a major clash on their mountainous land border, the Himalayas, in a state province called Ladakh. There was the most deadly clash between the two countries in 50 years. That hasn't gone away. That area is still heavily militarized. Both sides still have huge numbers of troops in that area. There is no formally designated border. And I would say that if we're looking at the next several years, the India-China front is a place where there could be a serious clash, a serious conflict, and America would have a big, big stakes in what happened there.
Well, that's a lot of food for thought. This is tremendous. Shashank, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, and I hope I haven't left everyone too depressed at the end.
Maybe depressed, but definitely edified. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.